Morning, please be seated. We have four cases for oral argument this morning on the en banc calendar. As you can see, the five of the justices are present in the courtroom. Justice Stiglitch is out of, she's up in northern Nevada, and she's participating by video. She may and likely will ask some questions while we're on video. And Justice Silver has had a long-standing conflict with today's arguments, so she will be participating, listening to the arguments in the case, and then participating in the disposition. Okay. Are counsel ready to proceed then in Osbaldo Chaparro versus the state? Case number 81352. Ms. Reynolds, how are you?
Good, thank you, Your Honor.
Very nice to see you and Ms. Noble in Las Vegas.
Thank you. Your Honor, may it please the court, Catherine Reynolds for the appellant, Osbaldo Chaparro. I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Yes, ma'am.
It's a bedrock principle of common law, federal law, and Nevada law that even if relevant, evidence must be excluded at trial if the probative value of that evidence is outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. This is precisely the issue before this court today. The general underlying facts of this case were largely undisputed. Mr. Chaparro was captured on video surveillance, grabbing LL by the arm, pulling her towards him, and groping her on a sidewalk outside of Harris Casino in Reno. Mr. Chaparro did not dispute at trial that he is the person in the video and that he had committed the offense of open and gross lewdness. The only factual disputes in this case were whether Mr. Chaparro digitally penetrated LL during their encounter or battered her with the intent to do so. Despite the limited scope of the factual dispute, the state sought to introduce testimony of PJ, who had previously accused Mr. Chaparro, 6 years before this incident, of following her to her car outside of Sparks Nugget, shoving her inside the car, and grabbing her breast. In that incident, PJ testified that Mr. Chaparro fled when she screamed. PJ never alleged any penetration or sexual assault or any attempt at it. In some circumstances, NRS 48045 does allow for the presentation of evidence related to a prior sexual bad act. But as this court established in Franks v. State, the evidence of a prior sexual bad act is highly inflammatory. It must still be evaluated for relevance and the heightened risk of unfair prejudice. In examining relevance, this court in Franks set out five factors to consider: the similarity of the prior acts, the closeness in time, the frequency of the prior acts, the presence or lack of intervening circumstances, and finally, the necessity of the evidence beyond those testimonies already admitted at trial. The probative value of PJ's testimony, as it related to the incident in this case, was very low. The instances were outwardly similar. In fact, Mr. Chaparro did not dispute that a very similar incident happened in this case with the victim LL. But PJ's testimony added nothing to those questions of whether Mr. Chaparro sexually penetrated LL or whether he battered her with the intent to do so. This testimony was unnecessary. Now, if you look at the other cases where prior sexual bad acts have been allowed because the court has found they're necessary, in Franks, Mr. Franks was accused of touching his young niece. He claimed the touching was accidental. In LeMay, upon which Franks was based, also involved the touching of very young children, children who may have been too young to testify. And the prior bad acts were admitted to show that the touching in the instant case was with sexual intent. And finally, most recently, in Flowers v. State, which was decided by this court in 2020, involved a murder and a sexual assault, in which Flowers was one of two possible contributors of DNA that was recovered from the victim's body. He disputed his identity as the assailant and claimed that the sexual intercourse between him and the victim was consensual. If you look at this case, there was no claim that any touching was accidental. There was no claim that Mr. Chaparro was not the person who was involved in that incident. Instead, you have a case where the danger of unfair prejudice is extremely high. Absolutely, upon hearing what happened in this case, and then hearing that it had happened before, there would be an absolute tendency for any juror to say that this is not a person who we want out in the community, and that he should be incarcerated as long as possible. There was an absolute tendency, as set forth in Big Pond, that there was a danger that the jury was going to convict him because he was a bad person, because he was not a person they wanted out in this.
Ms. Reynolds, I'm sure it's in the record, and I'm sorry, I just want to make sure I understand. The prior bad act that was brought out at trial, was that conviction based on a guilty plea or was it a trial?
That conviction was based on a jury trial.
Okay.
So insofar as the testimony, and I think what's really important here is to look at more so the testimony that was presented at trial rather than the jury's holding in that case, because I think to do so would really usurp the function of the jury in this case to discern Mr. Chaparro's intent in this instance.
But so a conviction was presented in the trial in this case.
Yes.
Of a prior, and the conviction in that prior case was battery with intent to commit sexual assault.
The conviction was admitted, as was the testimony, the victim from the prior case.
Right.
Offered her testimony as well.
So the dispute in this case, as you said, there was basically a concession to open and gross. And so the real dispute was the battery with intent to commit sexual assault and the sexual assault count itself. Does the fact that the prior conviction for a similar incident was also battery with intent to commit sexual assault matter to the analysis, and whether it help the jury in this case?
I think in a way it is more unduly prejudicial because Mr. Chaparro has never made an admission of battery with intent to commit sexual assault in the prior case. It was a jury who found that, which would actually appear to usurp the function of the jury in this case to discern Mr. Chaparro's intent in this instance.
Thank you.
If nothing else.
Ms. Reynolds, this is Justice Stiglitz. But certainly they can consider that information for propensity. I mean, obviously, in sex assault, the legislature's made a determination that something like this, that is prejudicial, certainly, can be used in these instances to, is relevant for those purposes. Why doesn't it pass muster there?
It can absolutely be considered for propensity. However, even if relevant, if the probative value of the evidence, which in this case Mr. Chaparro would submit was minimal, is outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice, which in this case we would submit, given the similarities of the incidences, was extremely high. If nothing else, given the risk of unfair prejudice to Mr. Chaparro, he absolutely should have been allowed to voir dire regarding the existence of that prior conviction. The purpose of jury voir dire in any case is to discover whether a juror could fairly and impartially decide the facts of this case. Now, from the pretrial motion practice, it was very clear that the testimony and the fact of Mr. Chaparro's prior conviction was going to be admitted. Franks itself clearly contemplates that when this evidence is admitted, there's absolutely a danger that a juror might convict on the basis of the prior act rather than on the facts of this case. And Mr. Chaparro was entitled and should have been given the opportunity to voir dire those jurors to ensure that they understood that he was not automatically guilty, that they still
Let me ask you if I could, counsel, and I apologize for interrupting, but when you get down a slippery slope there, when you start talking to jurors about facts in a case, so where does it stop? If you have a case with DNA evidence that can be very inculpatory, or a case in which an alleged victim is injured very brutally, I mean, how far do you go in saying, I want to talk to the jurors about these particular facts, which then takes everything out of context for what's going to occur during the trial? That's the danger of going into facts during voir dire.
I understand, Justice Herndon, and I think the district court absolutely does have some discretion to restrict the scope of voir dire. But however, NRS 175.031 provides that the scope of supplemental examination must not be unreasonably restricted. I don't know how far it may have been restricted because the parties weren't allowed to address it in the first place.
What question did counsel say he wanted to ask of the jurors?
Your Honor, in the record, there
or
was
she,
a,
she,
I'm sorry, there
know.
Was there was a bench conference between counsel that was not recorded,
uh-huh.
wherein it was later memorialized in chambers that they had discussed the prior conduct. The district court stated that he believed that Mr. Chaparro could not pre-try the facts of the case,
right.
so he informed counsel they could not inquire.
Right, and certainly you can't say to the jury, well, if the evidence shows X, Y, and Z, what would your verdict be, right? Clearly, that would be an improper question, so that's why I was trying to clarify what exactly counsel wanted to ask and is arguing on appeal they should have been able to ask.
And at this point, the record is unclear as to the precise question, but the district court
Isn't
made it clear.
Isn't it your defense counsel's job to make sure it's on the record that what they wanted to do?
And they did memorialize that they wanted to ask a question regarding the prior conviction, and the district court stated they could not inquire into the subject matter. Now, if you can contrast...
Well, maybe just to be clear, because I shared that concern, your understanding was they were seeking to ask the jurors whether, if they found out the defendant was previously convicted of a similar conduct, would they still be able to be fair?
Yes.
Not just a generic, hey, if there's a person in the case convicted of a felony, could you still treat their testimony fairly? But it was more specific as to similar conduct.
The precise question is not on the record, but I think that it would have been appropriate to have at least allowed a hypothetical that if a person has done this before, does that or would you still be able to convict on the facts of this offense? If you look at the questions the state was allowed to ask, they were allowed to confirm that a victim does not have to provide corroborating physical proof to their testimony. The state was allowed to inquire about whether a written statement could be affected by shock. The state was allowed to ask whether it was fair to require that
were those
a
questions
statement.
Objected to?
No, they were not.
Okay, counsel, I mean, there's no, but he did it first rule.
I think what it is showing is that the state was allowed to look at what may be troublesome factual issues in their case, or issues where the jury was going to be presented with facts that were troubling, or that they needed to know that the jury could still be impartial or follow their duty to follow the law. Mr. Chaparro wanted to ask a similar question. So to call Mr. Chaparro to be pre-trying the facts of the case, while for the state to ask similar questions, was an unreasonable restriction. And finally, I'd like to address Mr. Chaparro's objection to the sentencing by Zoom in this case.
Before you do that, because I think it's germane to the other arguments you've been making, I'd like you to address the use of inconclusive DNA evidence. DNA, this is an interesting case and perhaps one where this court should take that subject up. And I found it very interesting in this matter, particularly since the facts in this case, at least from my perspective, are very close. There seems to be some authority that addresses a test associated with whether or not inconclusive DNA test results are admissible at all. Wondering if you have a position on this or a comment you'd like to share.
And with respect to that DNA evidence, under Marks in this court's more recent holding in Valentine, when there are inconclusive results, Mr. Chaparro's objection here was that allowing the state's expert to make statements such as anyone could be excluded or everyone could be included necessarily has an implication that the defendant could also be included. So in a case such as that, under Marks and Valentine, he would submit that it was an abuse of discretion to allow that testimony, and that given that the DNA results were inconclusive, they should have been excluded in this case.
So are you proffering that at any time that there's inconclusive DNA results, there should just be a blanket proposition that it is inadmissible?
I think that...
And to be fair to you, I mean, let me just kind of give you an example. To the extent semen is recovered in a sexual assault kit, but an identity of a perpetrator can't be determined from that, the fact of semen being found can be very probative of issues in the case, right? Even though you can't identify who it is that left the semen that was found in the rape kit.
That is correct. However, the statements Mr. Shapiro takes object to specifically is the statement that anyone could be included and no one could be excluded.
All right. So you're still leaving room for inconclusive results could have applicability in particular cases depending upon the facts of that particular case.
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
Great. Thank you.
With respect to the Zoom sentencing, I'd like to make it clear first what Mr. Shapiro is not asking the court to do. The physical realities of the COVID-19 pandemic absolutely required the use of simultaneous audiovisual transmission in the past year. In no way should this appeal be seen as a request to overturn the results of those cases. Every time I've appeared in the Second Judicial District this year, I've been required to acknowledge my receipt of those emergency procedures and to consent and to state whether or not I have any objection to proceeding. Mr. Chaparro is the exception to the rule. He objected. Not only did he object, he indicated that he was willing to wait in custody until an in-person hearing was available. And finally, the state didn't object. While the state didn't object to the proceeding, they also presented no compelling reason as to why it was imperative to proceed that day. So for those reasons, we would ask that the verdict of the district court be reversed and remanded.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Reynolds. Ms. Stolman.
May it please the court, my name is Jennifer Noble and I represent the state of Nevada. Before I begin arguing, would it be permissible to remove my mask?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Justice Hardesty. Turning to the issue of the admission of the prior sexual act, the propensity evidence pursuant to NRS 48.045 sub 3, there are some important things for this court to consider. First of all, that evidence was absolutely relevant because the defendant did not concede that he intended to commit sexual assault. And so it was relevant to the state's obligation to prove intent in this case. Second, I want to just add something to the factual recitation about that prior incident. Although it was a 2011 battery with intent to commit sexual assault, the actual event, the sexual assault in this case occurred just under a year, I believe, after Mr. Chaparro was released from probation. And so I think that's important for this court's consideration when we're talking about the Franks factors. The judge in this case looked at all of those factors and he issued a detailed order going through each of the factors in Franks, talking about the similarities between the two incidents. For example, Pamela, who was the first victim, in her case, the defendant followed her from the Nugget into the parking lot, shoved her inside her car, laid on top of her with an erection, and told her to, quote, just relax and let it happen. That's what happened in that case, but she screamed, and it scared him off. And so I don't think that the distinction between penetration versus no penetration is relevant to this court's consideration because certainly there was evidence in that case, and a jury indeed found, that he intended to commit sexual assault. In this case with Lindsay, he follows her from the El Dorado under the Reno Arch, grabs her, ropes her, and digitally penetrates her. And in both of the cases, interestingly enough, Mr. Chaparro leaves when the women threaten to call 911 or yell, etc. But even Mr. Chaparro recognized that this element of intent was important because he told Lindsay, go ahead and call 911, go ahead and tell. Who are they going to believe, you or me? So certainly evidence regarding intent is relevant in this case. The court carefully considered the Franks factors. This meets each one of those tests. And simply because this evidence is not helpful to the defendant doesn't mean that it's inadmissible in this case. With regard to the voir dire issue, I would ask the court to take a look at the voir dire in this case. The state asks general questions about victim responses to trauma, varying reactions to sexual assault, reasons not to report, and whether or not these jurors could consider digital penetration as a sexual assault. Now, while the digital penetration is perhaps more specific, it's not getting into the weeds of the case. Now, it's true that there was a discussion held off the record in this case, but essentially the gravamen of the argument during voir dire was that counsel should have been able to question the jury about whether or not they want to unlawfully shift the burden of proof onto the defendant based on this propensity evidence. And the as I read the record, there was discussion about talking about specific facts of the incident related to Pamela, the first victim. And the judge in this case certainly did not abuse his discretion when denying that request. And as the court noted, there was no objection to the state's voir dire. So I think there's no error there. Yes.
Ms. Noble, let's just Justice Stiglitz. Just briefly, it seemed as if the judge were at least suggesting almost a categorical ban on exploring this area. Now, I appreciate your pointing out the record. Perhaps the questions that were suggested or implied they were going to be asked may not have been proper in and of themselves. It wasn't error for the judge to categorically exclude at least exploring with the jury that a fact that was determined to come into, that was going to be determined to come into evidence that was going to be central to the case. And was like a grenade. I mean, it's important to find out the jurors before you're in the middle of a trial. And many other jurisdictions have allowed you to inquire about their feelings about people who are felons, you know, or whatnot. So help me find the balance between a categorical, you can't ask anything about a prior, and what happened here.
Thank you for the question, Justice Stiglitz. I think when we're talking about this, I think a categorical ban on anything is probably not the wisest road to take. But in this case in particular, exploring the specific facts and the prior conviction with regard to Pamela wasn't going to be very useful, and you would have had essentially a mini trial about those facts within the course of the voir dire. And with Franks, of course, we don't have any indication that this needs to be explored during voir dire, so I don't think there's any clear error by the judge. But in terms of adopting a rule where we have a categorical ban on discussion of this type of evidence, no, I would say that that would probably not be something the state would be asking this court to do.
It seems like the court's comments about, well, no, you know, like if we talk about this prior conviction, that would be so prejudicial. But then that seems, you know, we're going to let it come in at trial, but we're not going to talk about it in voir dire because it's too prejudicial. If it's that prejudicial, maybe it shouldn't have come in at trial. What do you think about that?
Thank you for the question, Justice Kadish. I would respectfully disagree with you to some extent because lots of facts are prejudicial during trial. And this court and our legislature in particular has said that these types of prior sexual acts as propensity evidence is admissible. So simply because something is damaging to a client doesn't need to mean that we need to be talking about it during voir dire, because we could say, well, we actually have a videotape of the murder. Would that change your verdict? And, you know, probably it would. Sometimes the state has extremely damning evidence or helpful evidence, but going through all of that evidence during voir dire would be probably a waste of resources and could potentially create errors we're not thinking about now.
Ms. Noble, I don't want to be argumentative, but that response begs the very question Justice Kadish asked you. Why can't you talk about the facts that are going to be brought in at trial? Everybody in this case knew, apparently, pre-trial and before the jury was being voir dired, that this was going to be introduced. So if I can ask about one fact, why can't I ask about this fact? It is confusing, indeed, that the judge would say, well, this is too prejudicial, when, of course, that's part of the test, and preclude it categorically. Why isn't your response an argument as to why the defense shouldn't be able to ask about this?
Well,
how's this fact any different than the other facts? That's your argument. So why not allow voir dire on it?
Your Honor, thank you for the question, Justice Hardesty. In my experience, we don't litigate the facts of the case during voir dire, and certainly there's no guidance.
I'm not suggesting that there might be some middle ground between a categorical exclusion and some depth to which one might go in talking about prior bad acts or prior bad evidence. But the fact of the matter is, there certainly is some information that might have been appropriate. Have you ever been to that particular location? Have you ever, are you acquainted with people who know this person? I mean, I know the record is devoid of specific questions, but certainly there are some that could have been allowed.
Your point is well taken, Justice Hardesty, but in this case, the defense didn't seek to ask those types of questions. They wanted to ask, what would the effect of this prior conviction have on your verdict? Would you still hold the state to its burden? And our jurors are presumed to follow their instructions, and they were properly instructed in this case. So I may not have an answer for you on a clear rule to adopt with respect to this, but in this case, there was no abuse of discretion. There's no clear instruction to the court. There's nothing in the case law that contemplates requiring.
Well, I think the argument on appeal is that the categorical exclusion of the, of any questioning is an abuse of discretion. And you seem to acknowledge that a categorical exclusion is an impermissible rule. So why wouldn't that be grounds for, in this case, granting a reversal with respect to that issue?
Justice Hardesty, that was not the argument in the briefs. In the briefs, the argument that's made is that this is similar to Salazar, where there was a limitation on voir dire to 30 minutes, and that was unreasonable and arbitrary, of course. And then we have our Nevada statute 176031 regarding unreasonable restriction on supplemental examination. And what I would say is that in this case, Judge Walker denying the, frankly, fairly unclear but apparent desire of the defense attorney to go off into waters concerning prior convictions and the particular facts of the prior propensity evidence was not an abuse of discretion. It doesn't rise to that level there.
Well, it's certainly a learning experience for trial counsel. If you want to make these objections, you need to preserve the record and identify what questions you want to ask.
And certainly I think here the record in this case doesn't support reversal. We just don't have enough about the specific request. Moving to the DNA evidence, which Justice Hardesty, I believe you asked a question about. The contention by the defense counsel is that there was absolutely no reason for this evidence to come in, that it wasn't probative in any way. And they cite Marks, which is a Colorado case, and Valentine. Now, the witness in this case, the state's witness, said no male can be excluded and anybody could be included. That's the state of the evidence. That's at volume 4 of the joint appendix, 627 and 592. The court didn't abuse its discretion by allowing this testimony because it's accurate. Now, this can be easily distinguished from Valentine because in that case, testimony was that results were inconclusive with regard to a specific piece of forensic evidence. There are all kinds of other pieces of evidence wherein the lab was able to report statistical data, etc. And in closing argument, the prosecutor argued, well, you can look at this chart of this inconclusive evidence and draw your own conclusions. That's not what happened here. What we had here was that there were, I believe the testimony was that there was a mixture of about four males, low-level DNA, on the victim's tights or pantyhose, and that was what the jury heard. So that could include the defendant or could exclude the defendant, or they couldn't really come to a conclusion, but it wasn't a mixture of four female profiles, so certainly that's probative. And additionally, the Marks case, which comes out of Colorado, that's where, talked about that one, but basically we're talking about testimony about inconclusive evidence in these cases, but here we have something that is probative. And even if this court finds there's error, I would argue to you that it is harmless because in closing argument, defense counsel concedes that indeed Mr. Chaparro pulled down the victim's tights. That can be found at volume 5, 924 to 925. So they just argued that if he had penetrated her, those tights or pantyhose should have been ripped. So whether or not he touched the tights really is a non-issue in this case. It seems to be clear from the record that that indeed did happen. Finally, moving to the issue of Zoom hearings and sentencing. The appellant concedes at page 27 of the record that sentencing in person would have been impossible due to the COVID-19 pandemic. There was no objection here, despite the court's administrative order, which had been issued plenty ahead of time, until sentencing had actually started. And the objection wasn't, I want to be there in person because I want to see you face-to-face, Judge. It was simply, I can't see my support system. And Judge Walker responded that, well, at sentencing, if this were in person, you wouldn't be able to turn around and be looking at them either. So he just didn't like what he saw on the Zoom screen. That does not amount to a due process violation. And the cases that are cited are really not supportive of what they're asking for. Lipsitz is a confrontation clause case requiring physical presence. But again, the use of audiovisual technology was okay in that case for the unavailable witness. But that has to do with trial rights. We're talking about rights at sentencing. And under Summers versus State, there's no right to confrontation necessarily at sentencing. Cunningham is another case that's cited. And that's where sentencing of the defendant without counsel violated due process right. Mr. Chaparro was certainly represented. He could hear his attorney over headphones. And so that's not what we had going on in this case. And finally, Manning, which is cited in support of that proposition, talks about whether or not a defendant and his counsel are entitled to be present when discussing jury questions. So again, this is a trial right. So I would submit to you that this court should adopt a rule with respect to this, that in considering sentencing by audiovisual means during an emergency like the COVID-19 pandemic, judges should balance a defendant's constitutional rights with the responsibility of the judicial systems to hear, adjudicate, and dispose of criminal matters, the necessity of temporary procedures needed for the health and safety of those participating, and the victim's constitutional right to timely disposition of this case. And I would note that here, although the defendant said he wanted to wait to be sentenced, he didn't, may I finish my thought?
Yes, of course.
Thank you. He didn't agree to indefinite suspension of his sentencing. And indeed, the Second Judicial District Court is still not holding in-person sentences, and we are over a year later. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments today. The case will stand submitted. We appreciate your briefing and your input.